Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to introduce my guest, Dr. Michael Peck. You see, not only is Michael a talented and wise anaesthetist, he was my talented and wise anaesthetist. Mike and I worked together for many years in Washington, D.C., and he not only did a great job looking after my patients, but he was such a joy to work with, always positive, always upbeat, and we could jest before and after an operation, but obviously be totally serious during, of course. And more recently, we've been collaborating on a new concept in resuscitation, but more of that later. Michael obtained his bachelor's degree from the University of Cincinnati in biology and health administration, and then his master's from Wagner College in New York, and his medical degree from Ross University. He completed his medical training at the Catholic Medical Center, Cornell University, did anesthesiology at Beth Israel and Mount Sinai in New York, and then a fellowship in neuroanesthesiology at the Montefiore Hospital at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, also in the Big Apple. When we worked together, that was at the George Washington University, as I say, in DC, just blocks away from the White House. But he's also run a very large anesthesia practice, and he's also worked and taught internationally, and he has all the usual plaudits on his curriculum vitae, but I'm not going to go into all those. Mike used to take recreational vehicles, or RV, as they call them, trips around the USA with his buddies. But after partially demolishing one of the chain restaurants, a Big Boy restaurant, in a crash, that rather put paid to that. And I'm tempted to ask Mike whether after the incident, it wasn't a Big Boy, it was a smaller boy restaurant. Mike was also a competitive swimmer, and was even in a swim competition with the one and only and very famous Mark Spitz. So Mike must have been at least halfway decent. And he was also into skydiving. How he had the time to actually come to the hospital and do anesthesia is beyond me. Mike, Dr. Michael Peck, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello.
So I always like to start at the beginning, good place to start. Tell us about medical school and your experiences at Ross University, because it's not your typical American institution. You had a rather different medical school education.
I did. You know, there's a story behind everything, you know? So I ended up graduating from Ross, but that's not exactly where I even started from. So wait,
actually, for those who aren't familiar, Mike, just tell people where it is, and I think that everyone will immediately hate you.
Oh, okay. So Ross University is located, it was on the island in the Caribbean called Dominica. It is now presently located on the island of Barbados. The hurricane that went through it several years ago completely demolished it, and they had to move it. Dominica was a nice place to spend a little bit of time. The nice thing about being in an island like that, as beautiful as it was, is that you could still get your work done, even though it sounds like you would be sidetracked to do so. But every day was a beautiful day. So if one day you were busy studying all day long and sometimes all night long, you always knew the next day would be nice. You could take a break and go take a hike or go out to the beach. But that's not so different than other places. If you think about schools in Miami,
I went to Liverpool University, Mike. I went to Liverpool
University. Beautiful Liverpool. I heard it's a lovely place.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating town. But in 5 years, I don't think the sun ever shone.
Most of everything was about the Beatles, I think, right, in Liverpool.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
So, Mike, you were saying there's a story behind it, right?
That is correct. So way back when, in 1975 and 76, when I was applying for medical schools, there was a huge glut of applicants. So the competition was quite intense. I managed to pull out about a 3.8 GPA and graduate cum laude, and spent 3 years within the honors program at the University of Cincinnati. I was a little leery of my ability to get into medical school because my first interview was at the University of Cincinnati, and in walked one of the assistant deans, and he's holding this big pile of papers. And his first question out of his mouth was, "Why should we accept you? See this pile of papers I have here? All these applicants all have 4.0 GPAs. So their grades were perfect. Why should we take you? And I realized, one, he's trying to rattle me. And two, as I went, well, that's a very good question. Maybe you should take them, but did they work 20 hours a week to help pay their rent? Were they working in a hospital lab to gain experience? And were they a competitive swimmer? And that took up a lot of time. That sort of stopped him a little bit in his place, but nonetheless, they didn't accept me. I had a couple more other interviews, didn't get into school. And then I'm like, what do I do now? What should I do? Where should I go? I then actually spent a year working in the hematology lab at the University of Cincinnati Children's Hospital while I was pondering what to do next. There was more and more information coming out about going overseas for medical schools. There were a fair amount of people that I had heard of had gone to a school in Mexico called Guadalajara. And I went, no, I don't know if I want to do that. Is it too dangerous? Can I even, once I graduate there, can I get back to the United States? So I had applied, believe it or not, I saw an ad for the University of Navarra in Pamplona, Spain, of all places. I applied there, went there for an interview, one of the most stunning campuses I'd ever seen in my entire life with an unbelievable medical center. I got in and I went there. And interestingly, here I am, this kid who only had high school Spanish under his belt, taking an intense Spanish course, and then starting classes. Needless to say, the students in the class were kind of like amazed, shocked, and dumbfounded. I would be crazy enough to do what I was doing, but they were extremely helpful. So having to be forced to learn Spanish, you learn Spanish. I spent two wonderful years there. And then in order for me to get a residency in the United States, I was thinking, wouldn't it be easier if I went to an English-speaking school that had already relationships with hospitals in the United States? And that's when I kind of stumbled upon Ross University. I applied to them, was easily accepted. And then I had to just spend one semester on the island before coming back to the United States to do all of my rotations. And those were all mostly spent at the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, and it was lovely.
One of my teachers, going back through, and I won't mention his name, but he'd gone to medical school in Granada, and through him, I met the folks from there and had a wonderful, wonderful relationship with them and helped establish some services on the island. I think life is a rich tapestry, isn't it, of experiences. And in fact, I want to come on to one. You told me that you met a chap named Soshin Nagamini, who was the founder of the karate style that you studied. What life lessons did martial arts training give you?
Martial arts is an interesting process. One, you start out thinking, can I do this? And then you realize the long road it takes to actually get proficient. So martial art teaches you, one, it's strength building, it's team building, and it's a huge confidence booster. Once you realize that you could hurt someone fairly easily. And then you realize that that's a pretty important kind of skill that you just don't want to use unless you need to. In karate, one of the things, and certainly in the Japanese styles, one thing you learn is it's all defense. You do not fight back until someone strikes the first blow. Which is a little different than the Korean styles, etc. So you were taught to just hold back and wait and not be offensive, but be defensive. And that was also true in all the tournaments we would go to, right? So here's the interesting thing that you learned. It was fascinating. It really worked out well. I think not only fit my personality as sort of being the more calmer soul that I was, It was in the tournament, you would lose points if you actually had full contact with your opponent. So the idea was if you were to try to land a punch, that you would stop just before you would actually have contact. That was control, and that's what you got points for. If you actually lost control and hit your opponent, you lost points.
Yeah, well, probably upset your opponent as well. You know, Mike, I remember prepping cases with you, talking about the specific issues the patient had, what procedure I was going to do, you know, if we were doing a hiatal hernia and I needed you to pop a bougie down when, you know, we'd go through everything. And, you know, I, as you know, I'm keen in aviation, and it's we have a parallel. We call it hangar flying, where you go over the flight in your mind, if you will. So let's talk about the relationship between the surgeon and the anesthesiologist, as your job is styled in America, or anesthetist on this side of the duck pond. And what's the significance of that relationship?
I think the relationships are probably the same no matter where in the world you do this. As the anesthesiologist, anesthetist, and surgeon have a goal and to take the best care of the patient that they can in every instance, that relationship between the anesthesiologist and the surgeon becomes paramount. It requires open communication and honesty and respect for each other. So when you and I would have a conversation, I would say, okay, I understand. I know what you need me to do. And here are the things I'm concerned about. And there are things I might want to correct even before we got into the operating room that needed to be fixed, just to make the patient as best as they could be before we would render them unconscious and perform essentially the surgery needed to be done on them. Because, you know, at any time you perform surgery or even perform a general anesthetic, it's an assault on a patient. So you wanted to make sure people were in their best shape. The communications are important, not only before the surgery, but even during. So when you would have a concern, you'd say, hey, I've got this worry. I think something's coming. I found something else I didn't expect. And I would say, okay, great. Thank you for letting me know. And I would say, hey, these things are happening to the patient. I have to, can you just stop for a second while I correct some things? And we would continue on.
Yeah, it's like most team sports about good communication. I have to say, again, going back to my training, there was a wonderful surgeon I worked with. And there was an anesthetist who was the polar opposite of your personality. And he would complain and moan about every single patient being, you know, all the disease issues that they had. And my surgical mentor said, you know, my dear chap, he said, it's my practice to only operate on sick people. So I know that I certainly valued your very calming and erudite and pragmatic approach. Well, let's go to another aspect of practice. When I was taking emergency call, Mike, my heart would race if I was told there was a trauma victim or a patient with an acute abdomen in the emergency room. I got a real thrill addressing those cases because I didn't know what I was going to be dealing with, right? So you've got specialty training in neuro. Are those the sort of cases you liked doing the most? What have been your favorite medical challenges?
So many over the years. Getting back to what you were just referring to, running to the ER. So there was also the adrenaline combined with the dread, right? What are you going to find?
Well said. Very well said.
How is it being handled? What's happening in the emergency room before you even get there? And then watching all the people doing what they need to do. Sometimes the events in the emergency room were well orchestrated, and sometimes it was freaking chaos. So as the anesthesiologist, we would often, even though we were usually kind of the quiet folks in the background, every now and then we had to kind of rear our heads and just yell at everybody to stop and then assign people to do certain things in order to organize the events. So those were the things. Once you could sort of take control along with the surgeons, and then everybody knew, okay, everybody knows their role, everybody knows what to do, let's just keep going. So that was always sometimes a bit of a challenge. But, you know, you had to do it. Because if you can imagine anywhere between 5 to 20 people in a trauma room, it can get a little chaotic. My favorite cases, of course, are neurosurgical cases, simply because I did a fellowship and I loved what those cases were. So the one of the thrills, you're talking about emergency things, is when we get called for someone with a intracerebral bleed, most likely from a cerebral aneurysm. And they had to go on for what used to be, essentially, we used to rush people to the operating room to control the bleeding and the aneurysms. Those were really quite challenging because they're already very sick and they're already at risk of dying. The blood in the brain would cause all this swelling. And of course, the brain can't expand beyond the skull. So it tends to push down in what's called the base of the skull and can cause all kinds of hemodynamic problems. And there again is where the communication with the surgeon is paramount, and the trust in each other is really quite important, because you had to have, obviously, the patient completely still. You had to be able to lower it right before the surgeon would want, as he was approaching the aneurysm, what's called the neck of the aneurysm, to put a clip on it so it wouldn't bleed anymore. You had to basically create a very low blood pressure to make it safer for that to be done. And those were very harrowing minutes. So it was always great, again, to have that trust and watching very nervously as the surgeon is approaching the clip with his instrument towards the neck of the aneurysm. And you're like, please, 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 nothing rupture here, because then it's a medical, almost medical disaster, and patients don't tend to do very well. So those were exciting. And then we get to the newer times when a lot of these cases were done in interventional radiology. And I used to love when we used to get called, hey, Mike, got a patient coming in, they've got an aneurysm, and we're taking them to radiology to put a coil in, which is basically a little piece of metal in the aneurysm so it won't bleed. And again, having the trust in the radiology folks. And I was always fascinated by those skills also, and the adeptness to take these tiny little catheters, run them from the groin all the way up, you know, the vessels in the brain, and watch them maneuver these things around. I always found that quite, quite fascinating. And on the other side, they were always fascinated and always happy with, thank you for providing the best care you could for these people. And then all this is done, the patient, we would, after the anesthesia, would wake them up, and it's like nothing ever happened to them. That was absolutely just lovely.
Yeah, fantastic. And, you know, we've talked over the years about the privilege of being a physician, the honor. Talk to us about the building trust with patients, because as an anesthetist, it would be rare that you would have seen the patient a long time before the operative or interventional radiologic intervention. So how do you do that?
Well, at the time, you know, during our time as academics, right, the residents would go, and even I as a resident, when I was still a resident, would go off. And in the days when people would come into the hospital a day before their surgeries, you would go and spend time with them. So you would already have the ability to explain things to them and build a relationship. At GW, as you probably recall, we had a pre-op clinic, and every single patient that was scheduled for surgery came through that clinic. It was manned by one or two nurses, a couple of the residents, and one of the anesthesia faculty. Everyone got seen, and it was absolutely a perfect system where if you could explain things in detail to the patient, they knew what to expect. They knew that, yes, they would get a breathing tube, but they also might get a special intravascular catheter placed for whatever reason. Plus, you know, a little catheter to drain their urine and whatever have you. And then at that point, if we needed a little extra help, cardiologist to see them, infectious disease to see them, whatever other consult we needed, we can then schedule it and it could be done. And that was absolutely lovely. Times then changed where patients were no longer admitted the night before. The pre-op clinic didn't make money, so you know, we had it was a budget cut, so all that went away. And then it led to patients basically coming in that day for their surgeries, and you now had minutes to develop a relationship, a rapport. They needed, you needed to build their trust in you because they didn't know you as an anesthesiologist from a freaking hole in the wall. Of course, their surgeons they knew, and they had a chance to look up, you know, the surgeons and their qualifications, and they had time to go to their office and see them and get to know them. But as anesthesiologists, we don't have that opportunity. So it takes several years to build the ability to know how to walk in, assess the patients, and know how to talk to them in a way where they would trust you.
Yeah, it's, I always felt that the chance to build that rapport with the patient, you know, I would have seen them normally either in my office or I'd have seen them in the emergency room or as a consult on the ward. And I'd be coming back to them with results of whatever test we'd run. And, you know, you think about it, the joke about having an operation, you're going to be naked on a metal table, paralyzed, surrounded by people you don't know, wearing masks, and they've got knives. What's wrong with this picture? So it really does involve that. And, you know, you're the guy paralyzing them. So I must admit, a lot of the developments that have happened in medicine, the day case admission, I do worry about, you know, older patients and getting them sort of set up. Of course, it costs too much money, and nowadays we have to think about COVID. Listen, I'd like to talk about some of the specific advances in anesthesia that have happened since I qualified. And actually, I qualified in 1981. My God, that's 40 years ago. It feels like it was yesterday. But that year, if I'm correct, the laryngeal mask airway was invented by Archie Brain, which to be talking to a guy who does neuroanesthesiology, that's classic. Tell us about that invention and how that affected the practice and what your thoughts are.
So the laryngeal airway was a milestone for the anesthesia world. I first started using that actually probably during my fellowship. So it was around 1989. Obviously it was developed by a nice chap named Archie Brain, nice British fellow, who I had the honor of meeting in a couple of the Anesthesiology Society national meetings. Very nice guy. But the laryngeal airway, if you think about all the times when we used to just put a tube through the vocal cords and into the trachea. And that was the routine when you had a general anesthetic. But a lot of times you didn't need them. For example, for more peripheral surgeries, like orthopedic things and some peripheral hernia repairs and joint replacements, if you're going to do a general anesthetic, putting a breathing tube in people is a bit more invasive. It requires the use of a machine to deliver those breaths. And that in itself is not benign. The use of the laryngeal airway in the operating room environment came in quite handy. You could do a general anesthetic, put in a laryngeal airway, which is essentially a device that slides in around the tongue. It's got a large cuff and sits above the vocal cords and actually allows the patient to then begin doing their own, breathing on their own. And you could still deliver an anesthetic gas or intravenous agents or a combination of those to keep someone comfortable and yet unconscious without the need of a mechanical machine. And outside the OR, for example, in radiology, in GI suites, in cardiology, when we needed to produce a general anesthetic, putting a laryngeal airway in was an easier technique and required basically just taking the laryngeal airway itself and inserting it without the other instruments that are needed to do put a breathing tube through the vocal cords.
Yeah. So I never met him in person, but I talked to him on the phone about an idea, and a charming fellow. I think he moved to Hawaii or somewhere like that. Not too shoddy. Tell us about video laryngoscopy, because that also came out in the period of time we've been around.
Yeah, it's interesting. So if you, the more common, well, the way most of us trained was something called a direct laryngoscope, which was essentially a handle which you would hold in your hand that was battery powered, and a little metal blade that came off the end of that. So it became an L-shaped instrument. You would then take the laryngoscope with that blade into the mouth to lift the tongue to look for the vocal cord so you can place your breathing tube. The difficulty there was you always had to have your eyesight to look through under the blade through the vocal cords. And once video laryngoscopy came in, so basically the advantage there was you no longer had to have a direct sight with your eye to the vocal cords. Now you had a camera that could have a much better view and actually look around the anatomy better. So for example, for patients whose anatomy might make placing the breathing tube more difficult, the video laryngoscope made it easier to do. I would, once the video laryngoscope was in common play and there were then devices that were reasonably priced and could produce a really good image, I almost completely abandoned the old direct laryngoscopy and went to video for every intubation I needed to do. Simply because it wasn't worth the extra risk. If you were doing the old direct laryngoscopy, you had an issue, you'd have to stop, you'd have to rearrange something, pull out a different instrument to help you be able to visualize those vocal cords. And the video laryngoscopy took out that increased time element, took that completely away, and made the placement of a breathing tube much more efficient.
It's astonishing when you think about it, and video endoscopy had been around already, that it took so long to make that link, because even a nimnod like me could intubate someone. So I'm going to ask one more technical question, and that refers to using ultrasound to place lines, because the way I was trained, it was anatomical landmarks and have a go. And thankfully, we mostly got the lines in, but some, if you missed, there were serious consequences.
You and I learned to do things that I'm not sure the youngsters today could actually do without the use of an ultrasound, right? So you and I trained also when we would do anatomical approaches to all these, placing these catheters into large vessels. And it worked really well, right?
Most of the time.
Yeah, but it wasn't very often. I only had one. When you think about all the neurosurgical cases we were doing at GW, and you and I trained where we learned to do subclavian lines and internal, placements in the neck and placements under the clavicle to get into these large veins. And rarely ever really had too many if you're careful, right? The incidences of the complications was pretty minimal. The neurosurgical cases we did, we put lines, subclavian lines, where you approach these big vessels underneath the clavicle for every single case, which always tended to like scare me a little bit, because what if you hit the artery and what if you hit the lung, and then you've got like an 8 or 12 hour case you're about to do. But it only happened once in all those years we were doing that. Now, the use of ultrasound, you know, it's interesting. Again, the same idea. So you used to watch, you know, the radiologists do ultrasound and look at images. You wonder, why didn't it dawn on any of the rest of us to like create an ultrasound to look at the anatomy and have a real image to work with, right? I mean, we were doing it. We were doing transesophageal echocardiography, which I learned way back in the, you know, during my 1 month of cardiac training at Mount Sinai. I did like 50 transesophageal echocardiograms. And I said, oh, here I am looking at ultrasound, looking at anatomy. But it never dawned on me, or most of the rest of us, to say, why don't we just take the same dang technology and use it to place our lines, the intravascular lines. So once ultrasound came out and you could image in anybody, right, the vessels, and then you could watch the needle as you approach that vessel, and you knew you were exactly where you were. You didn't have to worry so much about, well, am I going to hit some other structure along the way. And the value of ultrasound also is you take somebody that are thin, right, and the anatomy is pretty easy. You take somebody, you know, as the world, as the people we take care of have gotten much larger, that anatomy, the thickness of people make it more difficult. The ultrasound has taken away that variable for the most part. The other advantages of ultrasound, besides placing these lines more efficiently in people, is we learn. Okay, so we used to do a lot of, you know, as anesthesiologists, our goal is to make basically a painless environment, right? And then what can we do to, for example, if we weren't doing a general anesthetic and we wanted to do like a regional, which is basically blocking a region of the body for that surgery to occur without having to do a general anesthetic, we would use anatomical anatomy to do those blocks. And now then with the introduction of ultrasound, you can actually now visualize the anatomy and those nerves that you want to put a local anesthetic around to produce the pain control.
Right. Can you give us a brief overview? I know you've done some work in Saudi Arabia and with the Pan American Medical Society. You've done some medical missions. Talk to us briefly about those experiences.
So Saudi Arabia. So that was interesting. So that was back in 1995 when it was the year that managed care hit the healthcare finance system in the United States. And especially the academic centers, and then even more especially the academic anesthesia departments. Because the year before, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid decided that in an academic center, even though, for example, I would be supervising two residents, and that would be two separate surgeries, and then the department would bill for those two separate surgeries, and those monies would come in, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid decided, nope, you can't get paid for both those cases. You can get paid for one. And that kind of decimated the cash flow in the anesthesia world in the United States. And then the next year was the whole managed care. So it was like a double whammy. So as we academics who really just came to work so we could either do our research or take care of the patients, didn't have to worry about the business side, now you had someone smashing you in the face back and forth saying, you better learn about the business of medicine. So while we were struggling with that, there came an opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia to spend a few months and do lectures and work in their ORs and that kind of thing. When I was first approached, I went, no, why would I go there? And then I got to the point, you know, I said, it might be fascinating to spend some time in Saudi Arabia because the only time you could get there is if you had work. So at the time I had two small boys, I think they were 5 and 8 years old at the time. And my wife was pregnant with our third child. So, and this was a project that was then done through George Washington University, Duke and Yale and Baylor, and the University of Virginia. And I went, what the heck? Let's just do it. So we went over to Saudi Arabia and we landed at, I think it was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And we land in the Riyadh airport and we're driving to our housing. We're being driven there. And we're looking around, go, why is everything so lit up? So we landed it during Ramadan, right? So of course, people would eat their one meal a day and they'd eat late and the short and this and the shops were open really late. So now it's like 2 or 3 in the morning and people were up because they were practicing the religion all day long. So that was interesting. So I didn't have to learn about Ramadan and what that was. So that was fascinating to me. And then the hospital. I was very impressed. The hospital was wonderfully equipped. The cases we saw there were, some of it was routine, and a lot of it was because of a lot of the inbreeding in Saudi Arabia. I saw people with syndromes that I kind of just remembered from medical school. And again, there people would be admitted the night before and they'd have a syndrome. You have to go look it up and what all that meant. So that was a whole new challenge. Looking up all these syndromes and how to properly take care of people. The people, the Saudi Arabia was also fascinating. You knew what the Saudis would state sort of publicly, but it was so much different living in the country. It was the most wonderful, warm people, and I didn't expect that. So it was actually quite nice.
Yeah, I've heard that. Well, listen, Mike, I'm definitely going to have you back because there's some technological projects that you've been working on, and one, of course, that you and I are working on together, but I'm going to leave that as a teaser and not go into detail there. I like to ask all my guests the following question. If you woke up tomorrow morning and discovered that you were chief medical officer of the world, what three things would you do to improve human health?
One, we need to start at prenatally with an education so that the mothers of these children are at the best shape they can be for their developing in utero babies. We need to, and an extension of that is an education starting in either nursery school or kindergarten about diet and health, the proper way to eat, because that would have huge ramifications 30, 40, 50 years later.
Massive, yeah.
And because right now everything's like kind of arse backwards. And also, you want to make sure everybody has access to good quality free care without having to worry about paying for any.
Yeah, well, we could have a very long conversation. I know some of my colleagues, when I was practicing in America, would rag on about what they call socialized medical care in Britain, which is, of course, just single payer, no fee at point of service. People do pay for it here, but it's paid for from a tax, basically. But yeah, I think those are great ideas. Listen, Mike, as I say, we're going to have you back on so we can talk about our project together when it's a bit further along. But Dr. Michael Peck, Michael, thanks so much for joining us today, sharing your wisdom and stories, and for all you did for patients over the years, and frankly, for all you did to help keep me out of trouble. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. And keeping you out of trouble was not very difficult, Jonathan.
You're
You were a very adept surgeon. So thank God it was one of the things I didn't need to worry
Well, that's very kind of
about.
you to say. I think it's just because you kept them still for me. It's
There
easier than a moving
you go.
target.
Well, that helps. That's true.
Yeah. Well, everyone, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. There are plenty more archived at EMG Health or, frankly, wherever you get your podcast. So please do join us next week for another episode with me, your host, Jonathan Sakia. Meanwhile, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.